Chapter 14. Minister to it. The proofs. Now that the tumult and the shouting dies, and civilian life has dropped back into something like its usual routine, are naturally less definable than at the outset. One of the most evident is the spirit in which all kinds of privations are accepted. No one who has come in contact with the work people and small shopkeepers of Paris in the last year can fail to be struck by the extreme dignity and grace with which doing without things is practiced. The Frenchwoman leaning in the door of her empty boutique still wears the smile with which she used to calm the impatience of crowding shoppers. The seamstress living on the meager pay of a charity workroom gives her day's sewing as faithfully as if she were working for full wages in a fashionable atelier, and never tries, by the least hint of private difficulties, to extract additional help. The habitual cheerfulness of the Parisian workwoman rises, in moments of sorrow, to the finest fortitude. In a workroom, where many women have been employed since the beginning of the war, a young girl of 16 heard late one afternoon that her only brother had been killed. She had a moment of desperate distress, but there was a big family to be helped by her small earnings, and the next morning punctually she was back at work. In the same workroom the women have one half holiday in the week, without reduction of pay. Yet if an order has to be rushed through for a hospital, they give up that one afternoon as gaily as if they were doing it for their pleasure. But if anyone who has lived for the last year among the workers and small tradesmen of Paris should begin to cite instances of endurance, self-denial and secret charity, the list would have no end. The essential of it all is the spirit in which these acts are accomplished. The second question. What are the conditions and qualities that have produced such results, is less easy to answer. The door is so largely open to conjecture that every explanation must depend largely on the answerer's personal bias. But one thing is certain. France has not achieved her present tone by the sacrifice of any of her national traits, but rather by their extreme keying up. Therefore, the surest way of finding a clue to that tone is to try to single out whatever distinctively French characteristics, or those that appear such to the envious alien, have a direct bearing on the present attitude of France. Which, one must ask, of all their multiple gifts most help the French today to be what they are in just the way they are? Intelligence is the first and instantaneous answer. Many French people seem unaware of this. They are sincerely persuaded that the curbing of their critical activity has been one of the most important and useful results of the war. One is told that, in the spirit of patriotism, this fault-finding people has learned not to find fault. Nothing could be more untrue. The French, when they have a grievance, do not air it in the Times. Their forum is the café, and not the newspaper. But in the café they are talking as freely as ever, discriminating as keenly, and judging as passionately. The difference is that the very exercise of their intelligence on a problem larger and more difficult than any they have hitherto faced has freed them from the dominion of most of the prejudices, catchwords and conventions that directed opinion before the war. Then their intelligence ran in fixed channels. Now it has overflowed its banks. This release has produced an immediate readjusting of all the elements of national life. In great trials a race is tested by its values, and the war has shown the world what are the real values of France. Never for an instant has this people, so expert in the great art of living, imagined that life consisted in being alive. Enamored of pleasure and beauty, dwelling freely and frankly in the present, they have yet kept their sense of larger meanings, have understood life to be made up of many things past and to come, of renunciation as well as satisfaction, of traditions as well as experiments, of dying as much as of living. Never have they considered life as a thing to be cherished in itself, apart from its reactions and its relations. Intelligence first, then, has helped France to be what she is, and next, perhaps, one of its corollaries, expression. The French are the first to laugh at themselves for running to words. They seem to regard their gift for expression as a weakness, a possible deterrent to action. The last year has not confirmed that view. It has rather shown that eloquence is a supplementary weapon. By eloquence I naturally do not mean public speaking, nor yet the rhetorical writing too often associated with the word. Rhetoric is the dressing up of conventional sentiment, eloquence the fearless expression of real emotion. And this gift of the fearless expression of emotion fearless, that is, of ridicule, or of indifference in the hearer has been an inestimable strength to France. It is a sign of the high average of French intelligence, that feeling well-worded can stir and uplift it, that orts are not half shamefacedly regarded as something separate from, and extraneous to, emotion, or even as a mere vent for it, but as actually animating and forming it. Every additional faculty for exteriorizing states of feeling, giving them a face and a language, is a moral as well as an artistic asset, and Guy was never wiser than when he wrote, "A God gave me the voice to speak my pain." It is not too much to say that the French are at this moment drawing a part of their national strength from their language. The piety with which they have cherished and cultivated it has made it a precious instrument in their hands. It can say so beautifully what they feel that they find strength and renovation in using it, and the word once uttered is passed on and carries the same help to others. Countless instances of such happy expression could be cited by anyone who has lived the last year in France. On the bodies of young soldiers have been found letters of farewell to their parents that made one think of some heroic Elizabethan verse, and the mothers robbed of these sons have sent them an answering cry of courage. "Thank you," such a mourner wrote me the other day, "for having understood the cruelty of our fate and having pitied us. Thank you also for having exalted the pride that is mingled with our unutterable sorrow." Simply that, and no more, but she might have been speaking for all the mothers of France. When the eloquent expression of feeling does not issue in action, or at least in a state of mind equivalent to action, it sinks to the level of rhetoric. But in France at this moment expression and conduct supplement and reflect each other. And this brings me to the other great attribute which goes to making up the tone of France, the quality of courage. It is not unintentionally that it comes last on my list. French courage is courage rationalized, courage thought out, and found necessary to some special end. It is, as much as any other quality of the French temperament, the result of French intelligence. No people so sensitive to beauty, so penetrated with a passionate interest in life, so endowed with the power to express and immortalize that interest, can ever really enjoy destruction for its own sake. The French hate illiterism. It is stupid, inartistic, unimaginative and enslaving. There could not be four better French reasons for detesting it. Nor have the French ever enjoyed the savage forms of sport which stimulate the blood of more apathetic or more brutal races. Neither prize fighting nor bullfighting is of the soil in France, and Frenchmen do not settle their private differences impromptu with their fists. They do it, logically and with deliberation, on the dueling ground. But when a national danger threatens, they instantly become what they proudly and justly call themselves warlike nation, and apply to the business in hand the ardor, the imagination, the perseverance that have made them for centuries the great creative force of civilization. Every French soldier knows why he is fighting, and why, at this moment, physical courage is the first quality demanded of him. Every French woman knows why war is being waged, and why her moral courage is needed to supplement the soldier's contempt of death. The women of France are supplying this moral courage in act as well as in word. French women, as a rule, are perhaps less instinctively courageous, in the elementary sense, than their Anglo-Saxon sisters. They are afraid of more things, and are less ashamed of showing their fear. The French mother coddles her children, the boys as well as the girls. When they tumble and bark their knees, they are expected to cry, and not taught to control themselves as English and American children are. I have seen big French boys bawling over a cutaway bruise that an Anglo-Saxon girl of the same age would have felt compelled to bear without a tear. French women are timid for themselves as well as for their children. They are afraid of the unexpected, the unknown, the experimental. It is not part of the French woman's training to pretend to have physical courage. As he has not the advantage of our discipline in the hypocrisies of haute forme, when she is called on to be brave, she must draw her courage from her brains. She must first be convinced of the necessity of heroism. After that she is fit to bridle with John Dark. The same display of reasoned courage is visible in T.E. Hasty adaptation of the French woman to all kinds of uncongenial jobs. Almost every kind of service as he has been called to render since the war began has been fundamentally uncongenial. A French doctor once remarked to me that French women never make really good sick nurses except when they are nursing their own people. They are too personal, too emotional, and too much interested in more interesting things to take to the fussy details of good nursing except when it can help someone they care for. Even then, as a rule, they are not systematic or tidy, but they make up for these deficiencies by inexhaustible willingness and sympathy. And it has been easy for them to become good war nurses, because every French woman who nurses a French soldier feels that she is caring for her kin. The French war nurse sometimes mislays an instrument, or forgets to sterilize a dressing. But she almost always finds the consoling word to say, and the right tone to take with her wounded soldiers. That profound solidarity which is one of the results of conscription flowers, in wartime, in an exquisite and impartial devotion. This, then, is what France is like. The whole civilian part of the nation seems merged in one symbolic figure, carrying help and hope to the fighters, or passionately bent above the wounded. The devotion, the self-denial, seem instinctive, but they are really based on a reasoned knowledge of the situation, and on an unflinching estimate of values. All France knows today that real life consists in the things that make it worth living, and that these things, for France, depend on the free expression of her national genius. If France perishes as an intellectual light, and as a moral force, every Frenchman perishes with her, and the only death that Frenchmen fear is not death in the trenches, but death by the extinction of their national ideal. It is against this death that the whole nation is fighting, and it is the reasoned recognition of their peril which, at this moment, is making the most intelligent people in the world the most sublime. The end. End of the Project Gutenberg, a text of Fighting France by Edith Wharton. FGHTN by Gutenberg Edition.